Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Mohi Alwash. Mohi is a food security cluster coordinator at the United Nations World Food Program with experience of more than 12 years in the humanitarian sector, coordinating with humanitarian stakeholders, specializing in humanitarian programming response and cluster coordination.
Mohi, thank you so much for coming on Tolerable Risk. What we're going to talk about today, specifically the UN cluster system, is really, really interesting. And I can't wait to get into the subject matter. But before we do that, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you get into the third sector? And how have you been working in the humanitarian world?
Thanks, Sabrina. It's my pleasure also to be part of this interview. So starting with actually how I become interested in the third sector. And this is just a little story. I'm coming from a refugee family. My parents basically came to Jordan after the 1967 war as Palestinian refugees. I have grown up in a Palestinian camp and communities in Amman in Jordan. And I've been to the UNRWA schools, which is the Palestinian Refugees United Nation, which I was one of the students basically sitting on the classrooms back then until I got to the high school. Why I basically mentioned this story, because back then I really was thinking a lot of how I can get more help. So I believed that this is the sector where I can give a hand and help others. And there where my interest become more high to this sector, to the third sector, and also to the humanitarian work. I am working now with the United Nations World Food Program as Food Security Cluster Coordinator, particularly on Syria response. I have been working in the humanitarian sector for almost 12 years, my expertise area, moving between different NGOs and national organizations also within the UN, covering different emergency portfolios, including humanitarian response, advocacy, coordination, here getting to the activities level like food security, livelihood, emergency response, including cash here particularly, as well as working in different countries like Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, as well as Greece and Serbia, and Myanmar very recent, and continue now within my cluster specific work, which I believe we need also to increase more awareness on what the cluster does within our humanitarian sector. Lastly, my education. I have a degree of international relations and political science from London. It's a master, and I have studied in Jordan for my bachelor.
That's an amazing background that you have. What a story about how you grew up and how you decided that you wanted to go into humanitarian work. That's amazing. Really an impressive background that you have. And all of the different responses that you've worked on in your career, you have seen a lot, which gives you a lot of perspective, particularly in the humanitarian sector. So today we're going to talk about the cluster system and some risks that come with working in the cluster system, either within the cluster itself or how the cluster interacts with some of these humanitarian responses. But before we get into that, let's just back up and learn a little bit more about the cluster system. What is the United Nations cluster system? How does it work? And how is it used to respond to some of these humanitarian crises?
So the cluster system within the humanitarian response, it is very critical and important, and it has been created for a purpose that all stakeholders that work in the humanitarian response, including all different agencies and organizations, to work together, to come together, including the type of response, the approach, even to the activity level, that including harmonization, avoiding also overlapping, and the cluster then have been developed to become more as a platform. Also, in addition to the coordination on strengthening the joint efforts, is to provide guidance as well as to provide support to the partners that work in providing the humanitarian response. The humanitarian response can be split to the type of the what you are providing, what type of assistance you're providing, how do you want to help people, and which type of help you will be providing. And then you have a dedicated cluster for each type of intervention. By example, you have for food security, there is a food security cluster. For the water, sanitation, hygiene, you have also for wash, a wash cluster. Each cluster is based on the type of expertise listed. There are usually lead agencies, the United Nations, that also support and also provide resources for existence of the cluster. But by the end of the day, a cluster system should be working with everyone, should be also not biased to any partner. It should always respond to the needs and also respond to what actually the response is required. In particular, the guidance that the cluster is providing should help partners to design and also to plan for the intervention and the response that they are preparing for. That's why there are tools that the cluster rely on in providing those guidance, and very key tools that the cluster is providing, which is the humanitarian needs overview, that when the cluster work with all partners collectively to indicate what are the key needs and key risks that we need to consider before applying any intervention. And then the other tool is the humanitarian response plan. We indicated already the needs, so now it's time that we also provide a concrete response plan that also partners can develop based on that their projects, the funding that they are seeking to implement their activities. Lastly, now the architecture of the cluster coordination, it is kind of that you are in the middle of everything, all the stakeholders, and also the coordination. So it doesn't stop at one step. No, it should go also through all the cycle and all through the process, as well as if any possible or any ad hoc conflict or crisis that might happen. Cluster activation happens quickly, and in the long run, the cluster deactivation should also take place, because the cluster role is also to empower the partners and then become led by the government, by the partners who operate in response to humanitarian or development interventions in that country or in that region where the response and the cluster were activated at the first place.
Thank you, Mohi. Wow. So what a complicated environment to work in. I just want to ask a couple of clarifying questions. So is the cluster a decision-making body, like a funding body, or is it more of a coordinating body? How does the cluster actually then interact with the implementing partners on the ground?
This is a very good question. And this is question that we get every day. And that's why we really need also to expose more the system around the cluster and the awareness. I will be very, very honest with you. Usually within the sector, also some colleagues and some partners, they try to avoid the cluster architecture and how it works, because there is, unfortunately, in some areas, some misunderstanding. It's a very complex. However, when we come to the is the cluster is a decision maker, it is not a decision maker. The clusters is a advisory role where can provide the needed analysis, the needed impulse to the decision makers to guide and also to influence the decision that will be provided. So all the tools might be required, all the analysis and all advices regarding a situation or a process. The cluster key role is basically to provide that analysis and in very summary way, which regardless what the complexity of the situation. And then those results should inform the decision maker.
Thank you, Mohi. And so you mentioned two types of, I guess, reports or information sharing that the cluster will generate. One is the humanitarian needs. Is it plan or report?
It is called the humanitarian needs overview.
Overview. Okay.
So it's the humanitarian needs overview, and it comes as kind of a document, which we call it usually a humanitarian needs overview chapter. And it is basically summarizing the needs and just go to the key details for the specific cluster. So by example, for the food security cluster, we have a chapter which in 3-4 pages says until clarity on what are the needs particularly indicated through or after conducting the assessment. And which here you, by example, indicate what are the main key drivers for food insecurity. That could be including inflation, could include lack of water, could include et cetera, many different reasons. And that document where it tells you the story clearly, what is happening from the needs perspective with the country.
So you have the humanitarian needs overview, and then you have the humanitarian response plan. Who writes the overview and the plan, and how is information gathered for these two documents?
For the humanitarian needs overview, there are like clear process on how to launch the humanitarian needs overview. At each cluster, particularly who launched the process is the cluster related to the type of intervention. So the humanitarian type. Now, there are processes that include a huge and multiple levels of consultation. It starts with first assessment and assessing the needs. And this assessment takes place at whole country level with maximum resources available. And this informed by a framework including key indicators related to the cluster humanitarian type of intervention that inform the questions that will be asked. Then the results of the assessment will be applied through a specific methodology that inform the final results and findings of the needs categorized based on severity. If you give an example for food security cluster, there is assessment that conducted called the food security assessment, and that usually led by the UN lead agency and also by partners to collect the data. And then the results of the assessment comes to basically we apply the protocol of the food security needs, which is the methodology that we have multiple of indicators, the food consumption score, the livelihood COBE strategy, the reduced COBE strategy index, all these indicators. There are calculations specific on those results, how to be reflected to findings and percentages. Those findings then goes also within the same methodology to severity. And then this severity can tell you by the end which sub-district or which community is still food secure, which community and sub-district is in severe food insecure or moderate food insecure. Now, this process, I just try to simplify it in this way, but usually it takes time from 6 to 9 months from the preparation moment to the final results. Who is involved? From the zero point, from the framework, indicators, questionnaire level, we create committees that from INGOs, local organization, UN, all stakeholders, key stakeholders, and very important to have stakeholders representation for this process from each geographic area. So then the technical expertise from all the stakeholders response that they taking part of reviewing and participating in the tool, on the framework, on the initial validation for the results, and then also with the final validation for the results until the final summary, or let's say the humanitarian needs overview chapter, where all also partners contribute to the review, and also what we call it, the endorsement. We can't publish this document without the endorsement of all stakeholders participating in cluster.
So that's really interesting. You mentioned that this humanitarian needs overview can take from 6 to 9 months to generate. Is that a risk if you're trying to respond to fast-acting crisis or disaster? How does the cluster adjust the time frame from 6 to 9 months, or is that usually how long it takes?
Very good point. And here where it comes also to the management of the requirements for each type of response. In the regular or the usual response, where it takes exactly 6 to 9 months. Now, in very ad hoc response, and particularly in the emergency response, where conflicts just started, and especially when we have displacement, usually this is what we plan directly. And there is another way to approach such situation is to move ahead with the response, because if we don't move with the response as a stakeholders and a collective humanitarian to conduct assessment and then wait, then people might die. And this is why cluster also within the guidance provide for any emergency that we recommend to provide the humanitarian assistance ad hoc. And then after 2-3 months to continue and conduct assessment so we can understand to which level the situation is basically deteriorating. Now, there are also guidances that the cluster provide for those rapid responses, what type of activities you should provide. So by example, if you look at sphere standard, there are also type of guidances. Also that each cluster took that and developed different or let's say additional recommendations. For instance, if you speak for the food security cluster, there is a quick conflict happened. There is displacement. The first call that the cluster sent to the partners, we need to start respond with ready to eat kits. We need to start respond with any type of cash available. Whose partners there? Let's do that response for at least secure 2 months. And meanwhile, this response is going. We are trying to gather information. We are trying to find resources. Link to this topic, there are a lot of risks around also how far we are prepared. In some countries, this is also where it led because of the lack, or not say lack of preparedness, would say like the more focus that the stakeholders give to the moment at present without thinking of what could change. So the resources is very heavy for concentrating on at the moment, right? But then in some countries where I work at, when the displacement happened, we found in our coordination that we don't have the enough resources to respond to the people who needs actually the support. And this is where one of the key lessons learned now we are also advocating for is to basically study what possible risks might happen. And this is where here that risk, if we ignore it or if we don't really work on it as needed, the consequences is actually that might harm people. And this is people in need. So this is one example. As much as we want to have our response, of course, evidence-based driven, and this is why we need this assessment and we need this needs chapter to go out so it can guide all partners and stakeholders to develop and design the response based on the actual needs for displacement, for refugees, for IDPs. But by the end of the day, there are also parts where it needs a huge planning and also risk management when it comes to contingency planning, when it comes to preparedness planning, when it comes to anticipatory action. These areas where we need to start more and more put within our risk management strategy for the overall project, which when we come to the HRB, touch more on that.
Great. Well, let's talk a little bit about the humanitarian response plan, because then I want to get into, and you've been talking about risk management, because that's really the key. And before we jump into that, though, you mentioned the SPHERE standards. And for the folks that maybe aren't used to working in the humanitarian sector, I just want to mention that's the SPHERE handbook. It's the minimum standards that have been set forth for a humanitarian response. So, for example, how many liters of water a person might need, or how far away a latrine needs to be from a tent, something like that. So if you're not familiar with the SPHERE standards, you can find them online. So tell us about the humanitarian response plan now, Mohi. So how is that developed and how long does that take?
In response, usually to the needs that indicate, we need also to provide this guidance collectively also to the partners, which includes what do I need to respond with? What type of activities I need to provide? I did indicate the need, so how I'm going to respond. Then this is why the purpose we have the humanitarian response plan, which speaks to the humanitarian needs of review chapter. So we have a significant deterioration in the food consumption score in the HNO. Then in the response, we need to have an activity, which is, by example, the regular food assistance or cash for food to basically mitigate of that need indicated in that channel. Now, the HRP process comes right after that the HNO chapter is circulated and endorsed. The process of the HRP is heavily relied on guidance related to type of activity, objective, speak to the object of the sector. Now, that includes different and multiple tools. So first, there the HRP chapter, which includes the narrative and the type of activities and how and where should be implemented, as well as other mitigations to take in place to basically ensure a proper implementation. Another tool is the logical framework of the humanitarian response plan. So here you have a clear objectives, clear indicators, clear output outcomes, as well as a clear reporting, and that all included as within the package. In addition to that, couple of documents where also could be a guidance in terms of specific activity, a package in terms of different several cache or modality. So it depends also of what context. Also the cluster should be flexible to meet basically the partner's requirements, what the partners need. And this is based on that, you develop the package for the HR. Usually it takes time, depends also of the context. So what is important about the HRP, it should be cleared by the humanitarian and workers and also the agency, the organization, the leadership, and with the government. And this is where it depends of where you are and also the negotiations, because there is all then will be discussion between the leadership and also the government, the line ministries technical in terms of where is feedback should be incorporated or revised. And this discussion can goes from 2 months to 6-7 months, depends of also the context. Also, the HRP usually is not discussed at cluster level, because for the HRP, each cluster prepare their own specific standalone HRB, but then OCHEC goes with the whole full package of the overall HRB that we call it the inter-cluster, and then goes provided to the government for approval or for clearance, and then the discussion continues. So these are the process of the HRP in a nutshell, but I think more details can be also provided. And there are more, a lot of resources, by example, on the humanitarian response platform that OCHA has, also has more details on how the process and how that works.
Awesome. Thank you, Mohi. So just again, to clarify for folks who aren't familiar, OCHA stands for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. So they genuinely are the coordinating arm of the United Nations when there's a humanitarian response. I thought it was very interesting you said that the humanitarian response plan is focused on objectives. My question is, whose objectives? How are those objectives developed? Is that something that the cluster develops objectives based on the needs that have been identified, or is that needs overview released and then the implementing partners or the funders that are wanting to work in response to the humanitarian situation will then come up with their own objectives? How are objectives developed for the humanitarian response plan?
Objectives creation, what we say, is basically rely on what are the outcomes from the needs, which will become inputs for designing the objectives. Now, when it comes to each objective, how it's designed, each cluster lead their own stakeholders process of designing those objectives. And the results of those discussions goes up to that final HRP. The discussion level, and let's say at the technical level, the cluster facilitates the discussion with including the key stakeholders. And here it relies a lot on the technical expertise and also the strategic expertise. Because sometimes the needs indicate that there is a life saving, and then the objective will be designed based on that need, will be very objective, also life saving driven. And then some objectives will indicate there is a need for moving or transiting from the emergency to the more early recovery context and also livelihood. So first we take the needs outcomes and then working on that as an input, but then there are a process of brainstorming and also consultation. On those consultations where the technical expertise come and say, okay, so the needs indicated there is a life saving, then I think we also need to have a more collective package within our objective that we can touch on the life saving, but also we encourage a little bit on developing or income creation. So then the objective can also be expanded. Also, each cluster determine how many objectives we want to achieve, how many objectives we need to have as our main critical guide. And then you can have from 2 to 4 to 5. That also usually is designed based on the partners and the cluster. These objectives also need to have definitely an indicators and speak to the objective. Also, that can be implemented. So it's very important when we design the objective that we also fully aware, even if the needs came out with very clear details on what response might be needed, but also when we design the objective, we consider what we could do and what we can do as the context apply. By example, we can't have a life saving objective when we are already there is no conflict. We've been there in that place for ages providing life saving, but there is market functioning, there is municipality, there are people looking for more employment, etc. So then the objective will become up with more language around the early recovery, more also around the livelihood. So this is basically in a nutshell how the objective is designed. But also we don't want to forget that the indicators speak to the objective. And also the measurement of the indicators and objective when we have also clear outcomes that can also tell us by the end of the intervention, where do we fall? And this is a lot of risk management in the program designing that we also have this happening again and again, where we want to work on the capacity of the partners when they design their own project.
Thank you, Mohi. That was really an amazing overview of how the cluster system works and how it responds. And yeah, it sounds complicated, but also very necessary. So thank you for that. So yeah, let's talk about risk then. When the cluster system is working on these documents and is holding its meetings and is, like you said, not making decisions, but supporting the actors, the stakeholders in the environment where they are responding, how does the cluster manage risk? Can you tell us a little bit about the cluster system approach to risk identification, risk awareness, and risk management?
So The cluster basically look at the risk in overall with all types necessary for the risk management, awareness, etc. in all the program cycle. So starting from the project design, from the proposal for the implementation, monitoring, and then also the closure, and particularly what next. Now, when we come to the risk, and this is where I want to also expand, let's say, as I said, within the program cycle, we come to the partners where when you design the project, you already got these documents already, but then each partner should work on their specific intervention and project, right? So you are an X area. So this document is guiding you, but then you need to carry on your assessment also to understand the exact needs in that area. Now, we always advocate, and this is what we work with the partners to also indicate what possible risks might happen. If one of the risks, by example, you can't carry on the assessment, maybe lack of approval, maybe some conflict happen, etc., then we work with partners to indicate those risks, especially when they provide the proposal or the project. So one of the risks could be there is no assessment. So what are we going to do? We don't know the exact needs in this area. And this is where we work with the partners that to include those possible risks they might happen. And then also, how do we manage the risk? And this apply on the example of the assessment. Then we come to the also to the project design. And then when the proposals goes to the donor and also comes to the cluster for the HPC system, that we always also indicate what risks that your project might face. It could be, as we say, delay in assessment, could be delay in implementation, could be also that you don't have access to the financial resources. And also it could be that there is a possible delay due to the type of activities, etc. And then the listing those risks will minimize and mitigate from the negative impact that could happen if the project stop later on or if the project struggle. Now, on the other hand, we request from also partners to detail how you're going to manage those risks. So you need to provide what we call it an assumptions. Those assumptions that can be the key lead of what if this risk happen, how I will mitigate this risk, and if I can or if I can't as well, what the possible or preferred action to take place. This also goes in the documentation when the cluster works with the partners to include it also on their project submission to the system that we all try to advocate for, the project module, we call it. So this is also something that we use it as a tool to monitor and also to work with the partners and reviewing those type of projects. Before they implement, they submit those projects to the clusters, and the clusters look at the details with the committees of technical expertise as well, then provide this feedback to the partners. And many of the feedbacks comes around the risk management. On the other side, this is like, let's say, the architecture by the book, right? But then we have always, you know, conflict and the crisis happen from time to time, and usually it's not, you know, signal to us. So it could happen anytime, like now, could conflict happen in this X area or Z area. What we also work with the partners as a cluster is to mobilize resources in advance for any possible contingency planning, for any possible preparedness planning. So we do have the resources. And here where we work with the partners on a risk matrix response management that we develop together, that this is what we have capacity in those areas where we don't have capacity, what type of activities we're missing, who will do that, who we don't have anyone, and why. So all of that, we put it in one like summary type of document that we work on it together, and that should be in place, because then we inform the leadership and management that this is where we stand. If there is a conflict or a crisis happened or hit or natural disaster, these are the things we are missing. These are the things we can do. And then leadership and management can support and push if it's a case of funding, allocation, if it's a case of access, if it's a case of lack of capacity or resources. So that document can really inform and can really give a clarity better in advance.
That's really interesting. So basically what you're saying is any of the stakeholders who are working in that humanitarian response environment in that area are submitting to you their project plans so you can coordinate them. And as part of those project plans, there's a risk analysis. And not only are you asking them to identify the risks, but you're also asking them to describe their monitoring or mitigation plan. So then you all at the cluster level have a good idea, and you were describing a document that you put together where you were identifying gaps where maybe no one is working, or a risk that somebody highlighted that needs some sort of response put in place. And at the cluster level, that can be monitored, and maybe you can support them on that. Is that what the cluster would do in that situation?
Yeah. And then more specifically, that the cluster basically at the designing stage, where we work with the partners and supporting them how to give more attention to the risks, particularly that part. Each proposal to different donors, not only to the HPC. You have, of course, there is big attention towards the needs part. And then you have the response section, LTSAT. What we are working on is with the stakeholders also to give the similar attention to the risk and assumption part of the proposal. So as you say, yes, they do submit the projects. As a cluster, we create committees. For example, food security and agriculture experts, they come together with the cluster. They look at each project. Then they provide this feedback to the partners. Then they revise the project based on the feedback given by the cluster and the committee. And those indicators goes later on as reporting when you want to see and look how do you do with the project. This also feeds to the final project reporting. And there is a lot of technicality discussion going around it, and also preparedness and also consideration for assumption in terms of any scenario could happen. I may add here what we also call it scenario planning. We use the word scenario, but it's actually what possible risk we could face. So by example, we have in one country that there is a possible conflict could happen. So then we start mobilizing with the partners. Okay, this is might happen. What do we expect risks might happen? Okay, A, displacement. Then we go with the scenarios. Displacement of how many people do we expect? Like 20,000, 40,000, 60,000. Then we come to each scenario, we develop assumption and also plans. How if there's some 20,000 based on the resources planning we did. So what risk we might have? Can we meet the needs? So it could be, oh, we can respond to 20,000, but then, oh, we can't respond to 60,000. So this is our main risk. We start advocating and sending messages as a cluster to the donors, to the leadership. If the displacement hit to 60,000, then there is a possible humanitarian disaster could happen. That we don't have the resources.
So the scenario planning is something that organizations, even if they're not working in the humanitarian sector, can do. And I find that not only scenario planning, but foresight planning, which is a little bit even broader than scenario planning, can be really helpful with risk management. So when the cluster is doing scenario planning, is this something that you typically do before a crisis happens, or do you do the scenario planning as the crisis is unfolding? And typically, how long does it take for the cluster to do scenario planning? And can you tell us a little bit more about how you do it? What do you use tools? Do you have a workshop? How do you do it?
In terms of how do we or when do we decide to do scenario planning, there are what we call triggers. These triggers so could be, by example, like moving or movement of military groups to the border, or let's say tension escalated between two countries at political level. So this example of triggers. So we have a matrix of triggers that should raise the alarm. How many triggers, if it hit, then we have the alarm that we need to start put forward the scenario planning. Now, how this happened from time to time, and this specifically, I'll be very honest with you here. Sometimes it's very prepared. Sometimes it's in advance. Sometimes it is not in place. So we become more adaptable for the situation. And the ideal, of course, the ideal is if we have it in advance and prepared more. Now, in these situations where we don't have it prepared, it's usually when it's a very new situation or first time that we are facing. And I would say here also, it's one of the things we may should give attention more to in before and just expand our risk analysis of what might happen or not. Sometimes it's actually not even within the expectations. It's just something happened. So then in terms of the timeline of all those situations when it's happened, like just at home, and we never face similar situation in that region or in that area, then the time is very limited. So the cluster, you might have to work actually like at night and evenings, which myself, even I ended up working on that a couple of times, because you have a very short time to prepare a contingency planning and scenario planning within 2 days, and then to inform the partners and then inform the leadership to move with the decision. In situations or let's say contexts when we have this more in advance, it can be or it can go more in seasonality or like regularity, like updating that scenario. So we have this document, the scenarios there. So we do it quarterly to update it if there is a need for an update. And how to do that is usually involve a lot of workshop, a lot of discussion, planning with the partner. So we conduct meetings, workshops, draft revision, and then also bringing expertise in terms of different type of intervention. And then based on those all discussions, we come up with what we call is a tool like contingency planning. It's this tool is not like, you know, template. It can be also revised, developed based on any context and also based on what type of activities can be developed. Sometimes also we need to consider, especially in any ad hoc emergency, that the scenario planning might not have the enough time or even to proceed with that. So usually on those cases, we move forward with the response because we don't want people to die. And then in the same time, we double hat or we overlap the process of the scenario planning. That again depends of the urgency, situation difficulties. So some examples, like if you look at last crisis we've seen in Ukraine, if you see like in other countries like in Iraq, Yemen, in Somalia, that also depends of the setup of each context on how that happened. And then the scenario also involve a lot of two parts, which is the biggest part of burden where we work on it at emergency. This is the one where you usually have a very limited time to work on it as a cluster. You need to operate and function quickly. So that usually time limited there. Then you have the development actually plan, which here you have more space and more time to contribute to. And also it's the nature of the response, which needs more time, like further response. And also you can work on more details when it comes to development.
Thank you, Mohi. And one of the things I really liked that you were saying there in that description was how there's triggers that you as the cluster system, when you're doing the planning in advance, when you're not responding to something very quickly, but you have this set of triggers. And as those red flags pop up, then you start to mobilize. I think the same thing can absolutely be done even in just regular nonprofit organizations, because what that is active monitoring. And that's another way of building your risk awareness and your risk response. So coming up with what are those triggers? What are those red flags that will raise our awareness to something happening so that we can be prepared and we're not caught off guard in order to respond? That's great. That's a very, very standard tool. And I'm glad to hear that the cluster is using that as well. In your experience working in the cluster, if you were to advise humanitarian organizations who are maybe going to be new working with the cluster, working in the humanitarian environment, what would you say would be the three main themes of risks? We know that risk will be very specific to the environment where people are working, but what would be three themes of risks that you see that normally would happen in a humanitarian response environment?
Indeed. Now, what do we advise usually partners to work on? A couple of things and multiple, let's say, very specific risks or top risks, as we call it. So one of the risks where we want also work with partners is program cycle. It is important to involve risk management within the program cycle. So particularly here, let's get to the specifics. Assessments planning, log frame quality, including indicators that you can monitor, particularly monitoring part. This is where we keep highlighting. This is one of the top risks. If we don't do that, then we end up with a project is not applicable to the needs where people are really looking for this support. Then also we're looking at the project or implementation doesn't speak to the outcomes and also to the objective where it's designed. Number two is basically the impact. One of the risks that we need to really give more attention to, what is the impact of our project? How do we impact or how do we bring addition to the communities where are struggling that with our support and assistance? So that also one of the areas where we keep working with the partners on ensuring there are like outcomes indicators, as well as there is more tools that can be developed, such as the impact reports that can measure the overall response, because this is very important to also inform the coming or the next project. Another risk which we also concentrate on is the preparedness. And here what we're saying is, okay, we have the project, this is our resources, but then how do we tackle basically any possible additional need and requirements outside of the, let's say, the scope that we are submitting the project for? So what additional or what flexibility we might have within our programming? Now, this is, of course, coming from where? Because when we faced multiple difficulties before, when the situation changed, when the context changed, then we need to adapt quickly, or we need to adapt after some time. We're not having this flexibility. We work with the partners, with NGOs, with the local organizations, and also with donors, and we have these conversations usually. There are different policies, there are different strategies there between all stakeholders. So as a cluster, we try to have this balancing, or we try to advocate for this balancing when it comes to the intervention type. Lastly, I want to just add one risk, and that this is the lack of integration approach. This is one of the risks we always, like, let's say, concerned about when at the cluster level. And now if you come like and you read different HRPs or different HNOs, you will see there is a lot of intersectorial work, encouragement around like more integration and more engagement between the different interventions. So by example, we have one, like if we have one partner, implement food security here, implement WASH supports here, they might be at the same community, right? So what we are looking at is we need to basically have these two speak to each other, because this is will be more cost efficient, will be also more impact overall to the community itself, rather than have this stand alone. So more intersectorial work is really needed, and more is more recommended. And this is where one of the risks possible, if we don't keep advocating for that, is that we lose the quality of the impact of the resources. So by example, like if you face drought in certain area, it's better to have like the food security, the WASH, water, and also the nutrition interventions together, coming with multi-sectorial program rather than each one run alone. And the risks, as I mentioned, that we could lose more money, we could lose more impact.
That's great, Mohi. And just for the people, again, who are listening, who may not be familiar with some of the terminology, when Mohi talks about a log frame, that is something called a logical framework. It's a tool that's often used in the humanitarian world or even the development world that lists activities, outputs, outcomes, overall kind of goals. And then, as Mohi was talking about, descriptions of those things, indicators of them, how you're going to measure and verify them, and finally, assumptions and risks. You can Google logical framework and you can see some examples of those online. Mohi, that is great. What you were just talking about leads me to ask this next question. So if what you're talking about with more cooperation and more cross, not even sectorial, but cross partnership, communication and coordination and collaboration, if you could talk to management and leadership of some of these stakeholders that are working in this area, what would you suggest for them to strengthen within their organizations, particularly around the area of risk identification, risk awareness, when they're working in the humanitarian area, but also working with the cluster?
It is important, and this is what the key messages we always try to advocate for is with board members, with leadership, and also with our partners. It's basically, we need to provide capacity building on risk management to our key staffing. This is very important. We always notice that we have resources. We deploy these resources for very key activities, which is, of course, I'm a big supporter of that. But then when it comes to that area, I'm afraid to say there is also some misunderstanding or concept that risk management should be mostly linked to financial, which I would love to hear also your thoughts on that, because I heard it in a couple of different platforms, which I think it shouldn't be only linked to the financial part, because risk management can be on anything. Now, if we look at the capacity building and for our staff on risk management, more awareness, why this is important, then also train them and build that capacity on their particular area. And here I'm also referring to, when we speak to partners, also to indicate which staff and team or colleagues they should be involved in that. We've seen like some of the practices that there are irrelevant actually, or they do a little work around key activities involved in the risk management planning. But what we are trying to advocate for is like, can we have particular departments, including such as programming, the program staff, grant staff, and from the resources that familiar already and have the knowledge in terms of the response, can we work on their capacity building? Then we need also another area, which I say, I think, is to incorporate more our risk management findings within our existing systems. So by example, for the risk management, where we have the resources, we have the capacity building already, we worked on it. Can we also incorporate that in our tools, in our planning, in our designing more and more? And then we can also track and make sure that we manage those risks as much as possible, even when we do the resource mobilization, when we do the planning, and also in advance to this process I just clarified earlier of the HRB, HNO, so that can be more also strengthened. And also we treat it as a part as the needs analysis or the response part. So I think that's one of the messages.
I agree with you, Mohi. I agree with you on the fact that I feel when you ask third sector organizations these days to identify risk, it's around fraud risk, or, you know, maybe it's around safeguarding risk, which is a good thing as well. But it seems to be an afterthought. It seems to be something that they do the program design, they put together the budget, they put together their resource plan, everything is done. And then it's like, oh, we have to do the risk assessment too. Instead of having the risk assessment be integrated into the development of all these things focused on what are we trying to achieve, it's bolted on afterwards on what are we trying to avoid. And when you do it that way, yeah, I agree. You don't really get a great outcome. I love what you said about having more diverse groups involved. You know, unfortunately, what I've seen so many times in some of these larger humanitarian responses is you have the quote unquote risk person who might also be like the finance manager and half of their time is also risk. And they're handed a proposal and they have 4 hours to put together a risk plan. And they haven't been part of the program design discussions. They haven't been part of the needs assessments, and they're just told to put together this risk plan and tick a box. And it's really unfortunate because that's when bad stuff can happen, because you were not really thinking through it critically. We're not planning for things. And then also from your point of view, like you were talking about earlier, if a partner is not really putting the thought into it, then you at the cluster level aren't really getting a good picture and being able to ensure that you have resources to help support gaps. So I agree with you. I hope that there's some folks listening to this episode today and will go back to their organizations and talk about better resourcing, better integration for risk awareness and risk management.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we need sometimes to take a step back. You know, we get into like this busy meetings, day-to-day implementation, and really we concentrate to this great efforts. All partners are doing amazing work, helping people. I think also, you know, as you said, I think it's sometimes we need to take a step back. Just, okay, let's re-look at what we are doing, and then let's see, reassess how do we do it, and then consider those risks. Because sometimes also with the emergency response particularly, and I can understand, I've been there, you've been there too, Sabrina, back then, and Jordan and Zatari camp time, how you get involved a lot in the response and hours, but then I think if we're taking a step back and then re-look, okay, we need now to do this again. Then we, okay, are we considering low risk? Some of those risks, by example, even staff care, some of this like risks, like how people also struggle with the response and also the beneficiaries, the accountability to affected population. So those are very important. Not only we need to provide assistance as needed, but also these things or these areas is also a key. So yeah, totally agree with you. And I think more improvement and more also encouragement and good, we have good examples in the field. We have partners who really incorporated very well the risk management. And this is in the cluster what we do. We actually call for these partners to come and actually present how they did the programming. And then it's more like sharing to other partners and then how to consider or to look at those good examples. And then like we can work together on how to become like more bitter.
That's fantastic that you do sort of best practice and knowledge sharing among the participants in the cluster, because that's really the best way to learn. So I'm so happy to hear you say that. And this takes me to my next question. So we know that risk is an ever-changing environment. We know it's quite dynamic. particularly in the humanitarian sector where things can change within an hour. So how do you stay on top of changing risks and changing information and trends in the area of humanitarian response and particularly risk? Can you recommend any good continuing education opportunities or reading or other podcasts or videos or webinars that people who are listening today could participate in, hopefully low to no resource intensive, because a lot of times our audience doesn't have a lot of resources. But if they want to learn more about working in the cluster, if they want to learn more about working in the humanitarian response sector, what would you suggest for them to go out and read or research or watch or listen to?
This is one of the main, actually, deliverables for the cluster is changing information. This is a main role that the cluster carry on. And what to start with, actually, and throughout this broadcast, I would really call if any friends are or folks are listening and they work in any country and they might not join or attend the cluster meetings, I would really encourage them to do so, because it's a very good platform where you have a lot of changing information. Even you go to the meeting, which happen once a month in any response and specific cluster. So you have different type of meetings, like food security run a cluster meeting, the WASH does that, all other clusters do the same. And even if you don't have that information available at that meeting, one of the good things that maybe also some colleagues doesn't know, that you can ask for it. You can raise that request to the cluster to mobilize or to find some examples or answer for your requirement. So this to start with, actually, for those who are involved in any response or even that works in both in the emergency or development, these platforms exist actually to change information. So I do really encourage you to participate and see and also contribute. Another places, and which this is a very good question, because people also struggle, like, okay, how I'm gonna understand really how the cluster operates, how do I incorporate risk management to the cluster work? Mohi, you've been talking a lot about tools that we just learned today about, or we just hear it, but we don't really get how that or what the importance or how that feed into our organization goals. There are many resources. So we can start first for free courses and trainings. Please go to the Disaster Ready website. It has a lot of actually good materials in terms of the cluster, how or also the cluster operates, coordination, also on the architecture of the overall coordination system in the humanitarian work and the UN agencies. Disaster Ready has also some trainings related to the risk management within the humanitarian work. So that's one of the sources. Another source, it could be also to go to the websites related to each cluster. So by example, if you want to go to the food security, you want to learn more about the food security cluster, you go, there is already global food security cluster website at a global level, as well as at country level. Even if you want to really learn about one specific country, then you will have also many documents, materials that can explain and also give you better knowledge in terms of the cluster work, as well as in the needs, the response, the guidance there exist. In addition to that, you also can reach, because this is a food security cluster, but also there are many websites for our partners. So you can go by examples for the lead agencies like WFP, FAO, also UNICEF, UNHCR. It depends on the type of intervention or the information you're looking for. And these websites have a lot of guidances, a lot of information related to the type of response, and also touch a lot on the cluster recommendations. Lastly, I think the OCHA website, where you can, if you really want to understand very well how the coordination system works and also the process, all the tools I mentioned earlier, the HRP, HNO, and those. Thanks, Sabrina, also for clarifying that to the audience, which is great. But if you want to also know more and more, and you want to get to the details, there is a humanitarian program website where you can go, and it's hosted by OCHA. And then you can have also access to many, many, many of those documents with also explanation on the why and how and where this takes places. Lastly, I think one of the good resources now, we're becoming, it's more and more common and it's more and more happening, which is great. It's actually webinars that takes place based on different or themes, I would say. So it's themes, topics driven that run by the cluster. So by example, if you want to get access to that, you can go to the food security cluster, global food security cluster. I know that they are running regular webinars that can be accessed on their page on LinkedIn or even on Facebook and also on their website. So these are a couple of resources just came on top of my head that I would like to share with everyone.
That's great, Mohi. And definitely, yeah, disasterready.org, along with all the other websites and webinars and things like that with the UN system, disasterready.org does some great, really kind of basic online learning in the humanitarian area. And I can definitely encourage people to check out that website as well if they want to learn more about humanitarian work. Fantastic, Mohi. Thank you so much for your time today and sharing all of your insights about the cluster. If people want to reach out to you because they have more questions or they're interested in learning more about the work that you do, how can they reach you?
Definitely. So the most accessible, actually, let's say, contact is on LinkedIn. So it's the same name, Mohi Alwash. People can shoot me a message or send me also my email information also there. So this actually would be the easiest way to reach out.
Fantastic. Great. Well, thank you again, Mohi. And everybody, reach out to Mohi if you have more questions. He's a fantastic guy doing great work. Thanks for talking to us about the cluster. Thanks for talking to us about risk. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Sabrina, for having me. Thanks, everyone.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.